from reality to representation. Footnote. The intelligent listener who gets the idea that rare events are not computable can skip the remaining parts of this section, which will be extremely technical. It is meant to prove a point to those who studied too much to be able to see things with clarity. Let me take another angle. The passage from theory to the real world presents two distinct difficulties, inverse problems and pre-asymptotics. Inverse problems. Recall how much more difficult it is to recreate an ice cube from the results of the puddle, reverse engineering, than to forecast the shape of the puddle. In fact, the solution is not unique. The ice cube can be of very many shapes. I have discovered that the Soviet Harvard method of viewing the world, as opposed to the Fat Tony style, makes us commit the error of confusing the two arrows, from ice cube to puddle, from puddle to ice cube. It is another manifestation of the error of Platonicity, of thinking that the Platonic form you have in your mind is the one you are observing outside the window. We see a lot of evidence of confusion of the two arrows in the history of medicine, the rationalistic medicine based on Aristotelian teleology, which I discussed earlier. This confusion is based on the following rationale. We assume that we know the logic behind an organ, what it was made to do, and thus that we can use this logic in our treatment of the patient. It has been very hard in medicine to shed our theories of the human body. Likewise, it is easy to construct a theory in your mind or pick it up from Harvard, then go project it on the world. Then things are very simple. This problem of confusion of the two arrows is very severe with probability, particularly with small probabilities. Footnote. This is an extremely technical point to skip. The problem of the unknown distribution resembles, in a way, Bertrand Russell's central difficulty in logic with the "this sentence is true" issue. A sentence cannot contain its own truth predicate. We need to apply Tarski's solution. For every language, a meta-language will take care of predicates of true and false about that language. With probability, simply a meta-probability assigns degrees of credence to every probability. Or, more generally, a probability distribution needs to be subordinated to a meta-probability distribution, giving, say, the probability of a probability distribution being the wrong one. But luckily, I have been able to express this with the available mathematical tools. I have played with this meta-distribution problem in the past, in my book Dynamic Hedging, 1997. I started putting an error rate on the Gaussian by having my true distribution draw from two or more Gaussians, each with different parameters, leading to nested distributions almost invariably producing some class of extremistan. So, to me, the variance of the distribution is, epistemologically, a measure of lack of knowledge about the average. Hence, the variance of variance is, epistemologically, a measure of lack of knowledge about the lack of knowledge of the mean. And the variance of variance is analog to the fourth moment of the distribution, and its kurtosis, which makes such uncertainty easy to express mathematically. This shows that fat tails equal lack of knowledge about lack of knowledge. As we showed with the undecidability theorem and the self-reference argument, in real life we do not observe probability distributions. We just observe events. So I can rephrase the results as follows. We do not know the statistical properties until, of course, after the fact. Given a set of observations, plenty of statistical distributions can correspond to the exact same realizations. Each would extrapolate differently outside the set of events from which it was derived. The inverse problem is more acute when more theories, more distributions, can fit a set of data, particularly in the presence of non-linearities or non-parsimonious distributions. Footnote. A Gaussian distribution is parsimonious, with only two parameters to fit. But the problem of adding layers of possible jumps, each with a different probability, opens up endless possibilities of combinations of parameters. Under non-linearities, the families of possible models slash parametrization explode in numbers. Footnote. One of the most common but useless comments I hear is that some solutions can come from robust statistics. I wonder how using these techniques can create information where there is none. But the problem gets more interesting in some domains. Recall the Casanova problem in Chapter 8. For environments that tend to produce negative black swans, but no positive black swans, these environments are called negatively skewed, the problem of small probabilities is worse. Why? Clearly, catastrophic events will be necessarily absent from the data, since the survivorship of the variable itself will depend on such effect. Thus, such distributions will let the observer become prone to overestimation of stability and underestimation of potential volatility and risk. This point, that things have a bias to appear more stable and less risky in the past, leading us to surprises, needs to be taken seriously, particularly in the medical field. The history of epidemics, narrowly studied, does not suggest the risks of the great plague to come that will dominate the planet. Also, I am convinced that in doing what we are to the environment, we greatly underestimate the potential instability we will experience somewhere from the cumulative damage we have done to nature. One illustration of this point is playing out just now. At the time of writing, the stock market has proved much, much riskier than innocent retirees were led to believe from historical discourses showing 100 years of data. It is down close to 23% for the decade ending in 2010, while the retirees were told by finance charlatans that it was expected to rise by about 75% over that time span. This has bankrupted many pension plans, and the largest car company in the world, for they truly bought into that empirical story, and of course it has caused many disappointed people to delay their retirement. Consider that we are suckers and will gravitate toward those variables that are unstable, but that appear stable. Preasymptotics. Let us return to Platonicity with a discussion of preasymptotics, what happens in the short term. Theories are, of course, a bad thing to start with, but they can be worse in some situations when they were derived in idealized situations, the asymptote, but are used outside the asymptote, its limit, say, infinity or the infinitesimal. Mandelbrot and I showed how some asymptotic properties do work well pre-asymptotically in Mediocristan, which is why casinos do well. Matters are different in Extremistan. Most statistical education is based on these asymptotic, Platonic properties, yet we live in the real world, which rarely resembles the asymptote. Statistical theorists know it, or claim to know it, but not your regular user of statistics who talks about evidence while writing papers. Furthermore, this compounds what I called the ludic fallacy. Most of what students of mathematical statistics do is assume a structure similar to the closed structures of games, typically with a priori known probability. Yet the problem we have is not so much making computations once you know the probabilities, but finding the true distribution for the horizon concerned. Many of our knowledge problems come from this tension between a priori and a posteriori. Proof in the flesh. There is no reliable way to compute small probabilities. I argued philosophically the difficulty of computing the odds of rare events. Using almost all available economic data, and I used economic data because that's where the clean data was, I showed the impossibility of computing from the data the measure of how far away from the Gaussian one was. There is a measure called kurtosis that the listener does not need to bother with, but that represents how fat the tails are, that is, how much rare events play a role. Well, often, with 10,000 pieces of data, 40 years of daily observations, one single observation represents 90% of the kurtosis. Sampling error is too large for any statistical inference about how non-Gaussian something is, meaning that if you miss a single number, you miss the whole thing. The instability of the kurtosis implies that a certain class of statistical measures should be totally disallowed. This proves that everything relying on standard deviation, variance, least square deviation, etc., is bogus. Further, I also showed that it is impossible to use fractals to get acceptably precise probabilities, simply because a very small change in what I called the tail exponent in Chapter 16, coming from observation error, would make the probabilities change by a factor of 10, perhaps more. Implication: the need to avoid exposure to small probabilities in a certain domain. We simply cannot compute them. Fallacy of the Single Event Probability. Recall from Chapter 10, with the example of the behavior of life expectancy, that the conditional expectation of additional life drops as one advances in age. As you get older, you are expected to live a smaller number of years. This comes from the fact that there is an asymptotic soft ceiling to how old a human can get. Expressing it in units of standard deviations, the conditional expectation of a Mediocristani Gaussian variable, conditional on it being higher than a threshold of zero, is 0.8 standard deviations. Conditional on it being higher than a threshold of 1, it will be 1.52. Conditional on it being higher than 2, it will be 2.37. As you see, the two numbers should converge to each other as the deviations become large. So conditional on it being higher than 10 standard deviations, a random variable will be expected to be just 10. In Extremistan, things work differently. The conditional expectation of an increase in a random variable does not converge to the threshold as the variable gets larger. In the real world, say with stock returns and all economic variables, conditional on a loss being worse than 5 units, using any unit of measure, it makes little difference. It will be around 8 units. Conditional that a move is more than 50 units, it should be around 80 units. And if we go all the way until the sample is depleted, the average move worse than 100 units is 250 units. This extends to all areas in which I found sufficient samples. This tells us that there is no typical failure and no typical success. You may be able to predict the occurrence of a war, but you will not be able to gauge its effect. Conditional on a war killing more than 5 million people, it should kill around 10 million or more. Conditional on it killing more than 500 million, it would kill a billion or more, we don't know. You may correctly predict that a skilled person will get rich, but conditional on his making it, his wealth can reach $1 million, $10 million, $1 billion, $10 billion. There is no typical number. We have data, for instance, for predictions of drug sales, conditional on getting things right. Sales estimates are totally uncorrelated to actual sales. Some drugs that were correctly predicted to be successful had their sales underestimated by up to 22 times. This absence of typical events in Extremistan is what makes something called prediction markets, in which people are assumed to make bets on events, ludicrous, as they consider events to be binary. A war is meaningless. You need to estimate its damage, and no damage is typical. Many predicted that the First World War would occur, but nobody really predicted its magnitude. One of the reasons economics does not work is that the literature is almost completely blind to this point. Accordingly, Ferguson's methodology, mentioned in Chapter 1, in looking at the prediction of events as expressed in the price of war bonds is sounder than simply counting predictions, because a bond, reflecting the costs to the governments involved in a war, is priced to cover the probability of an event times its consequences, not just the probability of an event. So we should not focus on whether someone predicted an event without his statement having consequences attached to it. Associated with the previous fallacy is the mistake of thinking that my message is that these black swans are necessarily more probable than assumed by conventional methods. They are mostly less probable, but have bigger effects. Consider that in a winner-take-all environment, such as the arts, the odds of success are low since there are fewer successful people, but the payoff is disproportionately high. So, in a fat-tailed environment, rare events can be less frequent, their probability is lower, but they are so powerful that their contribution to the total pie is more substantial. The point is mathematically simple, but does not register easily. I've enjoyed giving graduate students in mathematics the following quiz, to be answered intuitively, on the spot. In a Gaussian world, the probability of exceeding one standard deviation is around 16%. What are the odds of exceeding it under a distribution of fatter tails with the same mean and variance? The right answer? Lower, not higher. The number of deviations drops, but the few that take place matter more. It was puzzling to see that most graduate students get it wrong. Back to stress testing again. At the time of writing, The U.S. government is having financial institutions stress-tested by assuming large deviations and checking the results against the capitalization of these firms. But the problem is, where did they get the numbers? From the past? This is so flawed, since the past, as we saw, is no indication of future deviations in Extremistan. This comes from the atypicality of extreme deviations. My experience of stress testing is that it reveals little about the risks, but the risks can be used to assess the degree of model error. Psychology of perception of deviations. Fragility of intuitions about the typicality of the move. Dan Goldstein and I ran a series of experiments about the intuitions of agents concerning such conditional expectations. We posed questions of the following sort. What is the average height of humans who are taller than 6 feet? What the average weight of people heavier than 250 pounds? We tried with a collection of variables from Mediocristan, including the above-mentioned height and weight, to which we added age, and we asked participants to guess variables from Extremistan, such as market capitalization, what is the average size of companies with capitalization in excess of $5 billion, and stock performance. The results show that, clearly, we have good intuitions when it comes to Mediocristan, but horribly poor ones when it comes to Extremistan. Yet economic life is almost all Extremistan. We do not have good intuition for that atypicality of large deviations. This explains both foolish risk-taking and how people can underestimate opportunities. Framing the risks. Mathematically equivalent statements, I showed earlier with my example of survival rates, are not psychologically so. Worse, even professionals are fooled and base their decisions on their perceptual errors. Our research shows that the way a risk is framed sharply influences people's understanding of it. If you say that, on average, investors will lose all their money every 30 years, they are more likely to invest than if you tell them they have a 3.3% chance of losing a certain amount every year. The same is true of airplane rides. We have asked experimental participants, you are on vacation in a foreign country and are considering flying a local airline to see a special island. Safety statistics show that if you fly once a year, there will be on average one crash every 1,000 years on this airline. If you don't take the trip, it is unlikely you'll visit this part of the world again. Would you take the flight? All the respondents said they would. But when we changed the second sentence so it read, safety statistics show that, on average, 1 in 1,000 flights on this airline have crashed, only 70% said they would take the flight. In both cases, the chance of a crash is 1 in 1,000. The latter formulation simply sounds more risky. The problem of induction and causation in the complex domain. What is complexity? I will simplify here with a functional definition of complexity, among many more complete ones. A complex domain is characterized by the following. There is a great degree of interdependence between its elements, both temporal, a variable depends on its past changes, horizontal, variables depend on one another, and diagonal, variable A depends on the past history of variable B. As a result of this interdependence, mechanisms are subjected to positive reinforcing feedback loops, which cause fat tails. That is, they prevent the working of the central limit theorem that, as we saw in Chapter 15, establishes Mediocristan thin tails under summation and aggregation of elements and causes convergence to the Gaussian. In lay terms, moves are exacerbated over time instead of being dampened by counterbalancing forces. Finally, we have non-linearities that accentuate the fat tails. So, complexity implies Extremistan. The opposite is not necessarily true. As a researcher, I have only focused on the Extremistan element of complexity theory, ignoring the other elements except as a backup for my considerations of unpredictability. But complexity has other consequences for the conventional analyses and for causation. Induction. Let us look again from a certain angle at the problem of induction. It becomes one step beyond archaic in a modern environment, making the black swan problem even more severe. Simply, in a complex domain, the discussion of induction versus deduction becomes too marginal to the real problems, except for a limited subset of variables even then. The entire Aristotelian distinction misses an important dimension, similar to the one discussed earlier concerning the atypicality of events in Extremistan. Even other notions such as cause take on a different meaning, particularly in the presence of circular causality and interdependence. Footnote. One consequence of the absence of typicality for an event on causality is as follows. Say an event can cause a war. As we saw, such war will still be undefined, since it may kill 3 people or 1 billion. So even in situations where we can identify cause and effect, we will know little, since the effect will remain atypical. I had severe problems explaining this to historians, except for Neil Ferguson, and political scientists, except for John Elster. Please explain this point, very politely, to your professor of Near and Middle Eastern Studies. The probabilistic equivalent is the move from a conventional random walk model, with a random variable moving in a fixed terrain and not interacting with other variables around it, to percolation models, where the terrain itself is stochastic, with different variables acting on one another. Driving the school bus blindfolded. Alas, at the time of writing, the economics establishment is still ignorant of the presence of complexity, which degrades predictability. I will not get too involved in my outrage. Instead of doing a second deserto, Mark Spitznagel and I are designing another risk management program to robustify portfolios against model error, error mostly stemming from the government's error in the projection of deficits, leading to excessive borrowing and possible hyperinflation. I was once at the World Economic Forum in Davos. At one of my sessions, I illustrated interdependence in a complex system and the degradation of forecasting, with the following scheme. Unemployment in New York, triggered by Wall Street losses, percolating and generating unemployment in, say, China, then percolating back into unemployment in New York, is not analyzable analytically, because the feedback loops produced monstrous estimation errors. I used the notion of convexity, a disproportionate nonlinear response stemming from a variation in input, as the tools for measuring error rates go out of the window in the presence of convexity. Stanley Fisher, the head of the Central Bank of Israel, former IMF hotshot, co-author of a classic macroeconomics textbook, came to talk to me after the session to critique my point about such feedback loops causing unpredictability. He explained that we had input-output matrices that were good at calculating such feedbacks, and he cited work honored by the Nobel in economics. The economist in question was one Vasily Leontief, I presume. I looked at him with the look, he is arrogant but does not know enough to understand that he is not even wrong. Needless to say, Fisher was one of those who did not see the crisis coming. It was hard to get the message across that, even if econometric methods could track the effects of feedback loops in normal times, natural since errors are small, such models said nothing about large disturbances. And I will repeat, large disturbances are everything in Extremistan. The problem is that if I am right, Fisher's textbook and his colleagues' textbooks should be dispensed with, as should almost every prediction method that uses mathematical equations. I tried to explain the problems of errors in monetary policy under nonlinearities. You keep adding money with no result, until there is hyperinflation, or nothing. Governments should not be given toys they do not understand. 6. The fourth quadrant, the solution to that most useful of problems. Footnote. This section should be skipped by those who are not involved in social science, business, or something even worse, public policy. Section 7 will be less mundane. Did Aristotle walk slowly? Will they follow the principles? How to manufacture a Ponzi scheme and get credit for it? It is much more sound to take risks you can measure than to measure the risks you are taking. There is a specific spot on the map, the fourth quadrant, in which the problem of induction, the pitfalls of empiricism, come alive, the place where, I repeat, absence of evidence does not line up with evidence of absence. This section will allow us to base our decision on sounder epistemological grounds. David Friedman, R.I.P. First, I need to pay homage to someone to whom knowledge has a large debt. The late Berkeley statistician David Friedman, who perhaps better than anyone uncovered the defects of statistical knowledge and the inapplicability of some of the methods, sent me a farewell gift. He was supposed to be present at the meeting of the American Statistical Association that I mentioned earlier, but canceled because of illness. But he prepared me for the meeting with a message that changed the course of the Black Swan idea. Be prepared. They will provide you with a certain set of self-serving arguments, and you need to respond to them. The arguments were listed in his book in a section called The Modeler's Response. I list most of them here. The Modeler's Response. We know all that. Nothing is perfect. The assumptions are reasonable. The assumptions don't matter. The assumptions are conservative. You can't prove the assumptions are wrong. We're only doing what everybody else does. The decision maker has to be better off with us than without us. The models aren't totally useless. You have to do the best you can with the data. You have to make assumptions in order to make progress. You have to give the models the benefit of the doubt. Where's the harm? This gave me the idea of using the approach, this is where your tools work, instead of the this is wrong approach I was using before. The change in style is what earned me the hugs and supply of Diet Coke and helped me get my message across. David's comments also inspired me to focus more on iatrogenics, harm caused by the need to use quantitative models. David Friedman passed away a few weeks after the meeting. Footnote: David left me with a second surprise gift, the best gift anyone gave me during my deserto. He wrote, in a posthumous paper, that efforts by statisticians to refute Taleb proved unconvincing. A single sentence which turned the tide and canceled out hundreds of pages of mostly ad hominem attacks, as it alerted the reader that there was no refutation, that the criticisms had no substance. All you need is a single sentence like that to put the message back in place. Thank you, David. You were there when the Black Swan needed you. May you and your memory rest in peace. Which brings us to the solution. After all this undecidability, the situation is not dire at all. Why? We, simply, can build a map of where these errors are more severe, what to watch out for. Decisions. When you look at the generator of events, you can tell a priori which environment can deliver large events, extremistan, and which environment cannot deliver them, mediocristan. This is the only a priori assumption we need to make. The only one. So that's that. 1. The first type of decision is simple, leading to a binary exposure. That is, you just care about whether something is true or false. Very true or very false does not bring you additional benefits or damage. Binary exposures do not depend on high-impact events, as their payoff is limited. Someone is either pregnant or not pregnant. So if the person is extremely pregnant, the payoff would be the same as if she were slightly pregnant. A statement is true or false, with some confidence interval. I call these M0, as, more technically, they depend on what is called the zeroth moment, namely on the probability of events and not on their magnitude. You just care about raw probability. A biological experiment in a laboratory and a bet with a friend about the outcome of a soccer game belong to this category. Clearly, binary outcomes are not very prevalent in life. They mostly exist in laboratory experiments and in research papers. In life, payoffs are usually open-ended, or at least, variable. 2. The second type of decision is more complex and entails more open-ended exposures. You do not just care about frequency or probability, but about the impact as well, or, even more complex, some function of the impact. So there is another layer of uncertainty of impact. An epidemic or a war can be mild or severe. When you invest, you do not care how many times you gain or lose, you care about the cumulative, the expectation. How many times you gain or lose times the amount made or lost. There are even more complex decisions, for instance, when one is involved with debt, but I will skip them here. We also care about which, A, event generators belong to Mediocristan, i.e., it is close to impossible for very large deviations to take place, an a priori assumption. B, event generators belong to Extremistan, i.e., very large deviations are possible, or even likely. Which provides the four quadrants of the map? See the PDF for Table 1 and 2 from the Postscript essay for a tableau of decisions by payoff and a graphical representation of the four quadrants. The fourth quadrant, a map. First quadrant, simple binary payoffs in Mediocristan. Forecasting is safe, life is easy, models work, everyone should be happy. These situations are, unfortunately, more common in laboratories and games than in real life. We rarely observe these in payoffs in economic decision-making. Examples, some medical decisions concerning one single patient, not a population. Casino bets, prediction markets. Second quadrant, complex payoffs in Mediocristan. Statistical methods may work satisfactorily, though there are some risks. True, use of Mediocristan models may not be a panacea, owing to pre-asymptotics, lack of independence, and model error. There clearly are problems here, but these have been addressed extensively in the literature, particularly by David Friedman. Third quadrant, simple payoffs in Extremistan. There is little harm in being wrong because the possibility of extreme events does not impact the payoffs. Don't worry too much about black swans. Fourth quadrant, the black swan domain. Complex payoffs in Extremistan. That is where the problem resides. Opportunities are present, too. We need to avoid prediction of remote payoffs, though not necessarily ordinary ones. Payoffs from remote parts of the distribution are more difficult to predict than those from closer parts. Footnote. This is a true philosophical a priori, since when you assume events belong to Extremistan, because of the lack of structure to the randomness, no additional empirical observations can possibly change your mind, since the property of Extremistan is to hide the possibility of black swan events, what I called earlier the masquerade problem. Actually, the fourth quadrant has two parts, exposures to positive or negative black swans. I will focus here on the negative one. Exploiting the positive one is too obvious, and has been discussed in the story of Apelles the Painter in Chapter 13. The recommendation is to move from the fourth quadrant into the third one. It is not possible to change the distribution. It is possible to change the exposure, as will be discussed in the next section. What I can rapidly say about the fourth quadrant is that all the skepticism associated with the black swan problem should be focused there. A general principle is that, while in the first three quadrants you can use the best model or theory you can find and rely on it, doing so is dangerous in the fourth quadrant. No theory or model should be better than just any theory or model. In other words, the fourth quadrant is where the difference between absence of evidence and evidence of absence becomes acute. Next, let us see how we can exit the fourth quadrant or mitigate its effects. 7. What to do with the fourth quadrant? Not using the wrong map, the notion of iatrogenics. So for now, I can produce phrenetic rules, in the Aristotelian sense of phronesis, decision-making wisdom. Perhaps the story of my life lies in the following dilemma. To paraphrase Danny Kahneman, for psychological comfort, some people would rather use a map of the Pyrenees while lost in the Alps than use nothing at all. They do not do so explicitly, but they actually do worse than that while dealing with the future and using risk measures. They would prefer a defective forecast to nothing. So providing a sucker with a probabilistic measure does a wonderful job of making him take more risks. I was planning to do a test with Dan Goldstein as part of our general research programs to understand the intuitions of humans in Extremistan. Danny, he is great to walk with, but he does not do aimless strolling, flâner, insisted that doing our own experiments was not necessary. There is plenty of research on anchoring that proves the toxicity of giving someone a wrong numerical estimate of risk. Numerous experiments provide evidence that professionals are significantly influenced by numbers that they know to be irrelevant to their decision, like writing down the last four digits of one's social security number before making a numerical estimate of potential market moves. German judges, very respectable people, who rolled dice before sentencing, issued sentences 50% longer when the dice showed a high number, without being conscious of it. Negative advice. Simply, don't get yourself into the fourth quadrant, the black swan domain. But it is hard to heed this sound advice. Psychologists distinguish between acts of commission, what we do, and acts of omission. Although these are economically equivalent for the bottom line, a dollar not lost is a dollar earned, they are not treated equally in our minds. However, as I said, recommendations of the style do not do are more robust empirically. How do you live long? By avoiding death. Yet people do not realize that success consists mainly in avoiding losses, not in trying to derive profits. Positive advice is usually the province of the charlatan. Bookstores are full of books on how someone became successful. There are almost no books with the title, What I Learned Going Bust, or 10 Mistakes to Avoid in Life. Linked to this need for positive advice is the preference we have to do something rather than nothing, even in cases where doing something is harmful. I was recently on TV and some empty suit type kept bugging me for precise advice on how to pull out of the crisis. It was impossible to communicate my what not to do advice, or to point out that my field is error avoidance, not emergency room surgery, and that it could be a standalone discipline, just as worthy. Indeed, I spent 12 years trying to explain that in many instances it was better and wiser to have no models than to have the mathematical acrobatics we had. Unfortunately, such lack of rigor pervades the place where we expect it the least, institutional science. Science, particularly its academic version, has never liked negative results, let alone the statement and advertising of its own limits. The reward system is not set up for it. You get respect for doing funambulism or spectator sports, following the right steps to become the Einstein of economics or the next Darwin, rather than give society something real by debunking myths or by cataloging where our knowledge stops. Let me return to Gödel's limit. In some instances, we accept the limits of knowledge, trumpeting, say, Gödel's breakthrough mathematical limit because it shows elegance in formulation and mathematical prowess, though the importance of this limit is dwarfed by our practical limits in forecasting climate changes, crises, social turmoil, or the fate of the endowment funds that will finance research into such future elegant limits. This is why I claim that my fourth quadrant solution is the most applied of such limits. Iatrogenics and the nihilism label. Let's consider medicine, that sister of philosophy, which only started saving lives less than a century ago, I am generous, and to a lesser extent than initially advertised in the popular literature, as the drops in mortality seem to arise much more from awareness of sanitation and the random discovery of antibiotics rather than from therapeutic contributions. Doctors, driven by the beastly illusion of control, spent a long time killing patients, not considering that doing nothing could be a valid option. It was nihilistic, and research compiled by Spiros Makridakis shows that they still do to some extent, particularly in the overdiagnoses of some diseases. The nihilism label has always been used to harm. Practitioners who were conservative and considered the possibility of letting nature do its job, or who stated the limits of our medical misunderstanding, were until the 1960s accused of therapeutic nihilism. It was deemed unscientific to avoid embarking on a course of action based on an incomplete understanding of the human body, to say, this is the limit, this is where my body of knowledge stops. It has been used against this author by intellectual fraudsters trying to sell products. The very term iatrogenics, i.e., the study of the harm caused by the healer, is not widespread. I have never seen it used outside medicine. In spite of my lifelong obsession with what is called type 1 error, or the false positive, I was only introduced to the concept of iatrogenic harm very recently, thanks to a conversation with the essayist Brian Appleyard. How can such a major idea remain hidden from our consciousness? Even in medicine, that is, modern medicine, the ancient concept, do no harm, sneaked in very late. The philosopher of science Georges Canguilhem wondered why it was not until the 1950s that the idea came to us. This, to me, is a mystery. How professionals can cause harm for such a long time in the name of knowledge and get away with it. Sadly, further investigation shows that these iatrogenics were mere rediscoveries after science grew too arrogant by the Enlightenment. Alas, once again, the elders knew better. Greeks, Romans, Byzantines, and Arabs had a built-in respect for the limits of knowledge. There is a treatise by the medieval Arab philosopher and doctor Al-Ruhawi which betrays the familiarity of these Mediterranean cultures with iatrogenics. I have also in the past speculated that religion saved lives by taking the patient away from the doctor. You could satisfy your illusion of control by going to the Temple of Apollo rather than seeing the doctor. What is interesting is that the ancient Mediterraneans may have understood the trade-off very well and may have accepted religion partly as a tool to tame the illusion of control. You cannot do anything with knowledge unless you know where it stops and the costs of using it. Post-Enlightenment science and its daughter superstar science were lucky to have done well in linear physics, chemistry, and engineering. But at some point we need to give up on elegance to focus on something that was given short shrift for a very long time. The maps showing what current knowledge and current methods do not do for us, and a rigorous study of generalized scientific iatrogenics, what harm can be caused by science, or better, an exposition of what harm has been done by science. I find it the most respectable of pursuits. Iatrogenics of regulators. Alas, the call for more unconditional regulation of economic activity appears to be a normal response. My worst nightmares have been the results of regulators. It was they who promoted the reliance on ratings by credit agencies and the risk measurement that fragilized the system as bankers used them to build positions that turned sour. Yet every time there is a problem, we do the Soviet Harvard thing of more regulation, which makes investment bankers, lawyers, and former regulators turned Wall Street advisors rich. They also serve the interest of other groups. Phronetic rules. What is wise to do or not do in real life to mitigate the fourth quadrant if you can't barbell? The most obvious way to exit the fourth quadrant is by truncating, cutting certain exposures by purchasing insurance when available, putting oneself in the barbell situation described in Chapter 13. But if you are not able to barbell and cannot avoid the exposure, as with, say, climate notions, exposure to epidemics, and similar items from Table 1, the tableau of decisions by payoff in the PDF, then we can subscribe to the following rules of wisdom to increase robustness. 1. Have respect for time and non-demonstrative knowledge. Recall my respect for Mother Earth, simply because of its age. It takes much, much longer for a series of data in the fourth quadrant to reveal its properties. I had been railing that compensation for bank executives, who are squarely in the fourth quadrant, is done on a short-term window, say yearly, for things that blow up every 5, 10, or 15 years, causing a mismatch between observation window and window of a sufficient length to reveal the properties. Bankers get rich in spite of long-term negative returns. Things that have worked for a long time are preferable. They are more likely to have reached their ergodic states. At the worst, we don't know how long they'll last. Footnote. Most of the smear campaign I mentioned earlier revolves around misrepresentation of the insurance-style properties and performance of the hedging strategies for the barbell and portfolio robustification associated with black swan ideas. A misrepresentation perhaps made credible by the fact that when one observes returns on a short-term basis, one sees nothing relevant except shallow, frequent variations, mainly losses. People just forget to cumulate properly and remember frequency rather than total. The real returns, according to the press, were around 60% in 2000 and more than 100% in 2008, with relatively shallow losses and profits otherwise. So it would be child's play to infer that returns would be in the triple digits over the past decade. All you need is one good jump. The Standard & Poor's 500 was down 23% over the same 10-year period. Remember that the burden of proof lies on someone disturbing a complex system, not on the person protecting the status quo. 2. Avoid optimization. Learn to love redundancy. I've discussed redundancy and optimization in Section 1. A few more things to say. Redundancy, in terms of having savings and cash under the mattress, is the opposite of debt. Psychologists tell us that getting rich does not bring happiness, if you spend your savings. But if you hide it under the mattress, you are less vulnerable to a black swan. Also, for example, one can buy insurance, or construct it, to robustify a portfolio. Overspecialization also is not a great idea. Consider what can happen to you if your job disappears completely. Someone who is a Wall Street analyst, of the forecasting kind, moonlighting as a belly dancer, will do a lot better in a financial crisis than someone who is just an analyst. 3. Avoid prediction of small probability payoffs, though not necessarily of ordinary ones. Obviously, payoffs from remote events are more difficult to predict. 4. Beware the atypicality of remote events. There are sucker's methods called scenario analysis and stress testing, usually based on the past or on some make-sense theory. Yet, I showed earlier how, past shortfalls do not predict subsequent shortfalls, so we do not know what exactly to stress test for. Likewise, prediction markets do not function here, since bets do not protect an open-ended exposure. They might work for a binary election, but not in the fourth quadrant. 5. Beware moral hazard with bonus payments. It's optimal to make a series of bonuses by betting on hidden risks in the fourth quadrant, then blow up and write a thank you letter. This is called the moral hazard argument. Bankers are always rich because of this bonus mismatch. In fact, society ends up paying for it. The same applies to company executives. 6. Avoid some risk metrics. Conventional metrics, based on mediocristan, adjusted for large deviations, don't work. This is where suckers fall in the trap, one far more extensive than just assuming something other than the Gaussian bell curve. Words like standard deviation are not stable and do not measure anything in the fourth quadrant. Neither do linear regression, the errors are in the fourth quadrant, Sharpe ratio, Markowitz optimal performance, ANOVA-SHMANOVA, least square, and literally anything mechanistically pulled out of a statistics textbook. My problem has been that people can accept the role of rare events, agree with me, and still use these metrics, which leads me to wonder if this is a psychological disorder. 7. Positive or negative black swan. Clearly the fourth quadrant can present positive or negative exposures to the black swan. If the exposure is negative, the true mean is more likely to be underestimated by measurement of past realizations, and the total potential is likewise poorly gauged. Life expectancy of humans is not as long as we suspect, under globalization, because the data are missing something central, the big epidemic, which far outweighs the gains from cures. The same, as we saw, with the return on risky investments. On the other hand, research ventures show a less rosy past history. A biotech company, usually, faces positive uncertainty, while a bank faces almost exclusively negative shocks. Model errors benefit those exposed to positive black swans. In my new research, I call that being concave or convex to model error. 8. Do not confuse absence of volatility with absence of risk. Conventional metrics using volatility as an indicator of stability fool us, because the evolution into extremistan is marked by a lowering of volatility and a greater risk of big jumps. This has fooled a chairman of the Federal Reserve called Ben Bernanke, as well as the entire banking system. It will fool again. 9. Beware presentations of risk numbers. I presented earlier the results showing how risk perception is subjected to framing issues that are acute in the fourth quadrant. They are much more benign elsewhere. 8. The 10 Principles for a Black Swan Robust Society. Footnote. This passage was published as an editorial in 2009 in the Financial Times. Some editor, who no doubt had not read The Black Swan, changed my Black Swan Robust into Black Swan Proof. There is no such thing as Black Swan Proof, but robust is good enough. I wrote the following 10 principles, mostly for economic life, to cope with the fourth quadrant in the aftermath of the crisis. 1. What is fragile should break early while it's still small. Nothing should ever become too big to fail. Evolution in economic life helps those with the maximum amount of hidden risks become the biggest. 2. No socialization of losses and privatization of gains. Whatever may need to be bailed out should be nationalized. Whatever does not need a bailout should be free, small, and risk-bearing. We got ourselves into the worst of capitalism and socialism. In France in the 1980s, the socialists took over the banks. In the United States in the 2000s, the banks took over the government. This is surreal. 3. People who were driving a school bus blindfolded and crashed it should never be given a new bus. The economics establishment, universities, regulators, central bankers, government officials, various organizations staffed with economists, lost its legitimacy with the failure of the system in 2008. It is irresponsible and foolish to put our trust in their ability to get us out of this mess. It is also irresponsible to listen to advice from the risk experts and business school academia still promoting their measurements, which failed us, such as value at risk. Find the smart people whose hands are clean. 4. Don't let someone making an incentive bonus manage a nuclear plant or your financial risks. Odds are he would cut every corner on safety to show profits from these savings while claiming to be conservative. Bonuses don't accommodate the hidden risks of blow-ups. It is the asymmetry of the bonus system that got us here. No incentives without disincentives. Capitalism is about rewards and punishments, not just rewards. 5. Compensate complexity with simplicity. Complexity from globalization and highly networked economic life needs to be countered by simplicity in financial products. The complex economy is already a form of leverage. It's the leverage of efficiency. Adding debt to that system produces wild and dangerous gyrations and provides no room for error. Complex systems survive thanks to slack and redundancy, not debt and optimization. Capitalism cannot avoid fads and bubbles. Equity bubbles, as in 2000, have proved to be mild. Debt bubbles are vicious. 6. Do not give children dynamite sticks, even if they come with a warning label. Complex financial products need to be banned because nobody understands them, and few are rational enough to know it. We need to protect citizens from themselves, from bankers selling them hedging products, and from gullible regulators who listen to economic theorists. 7. Only Ponzi schemes should depend on confidence. Governments should never need to restore confidence. In a Ponzi scheme, the most famous being the one perpetrated by Bernard Madoff, a person borrows or takes funds from a new investor to repay an existing investor trying to exit the investment. Cascading rumors are a product of complex systems. Governments cannot stop the rumors. Simply, we need to be in a position to shrug off rumors, be robust to them. 8. Do not give an addict more drugs if he has withdrawal pains. Using leverage to cure the problems of too much leverage is not homeopathy, it's denial. The debt crisis is not a temporary problem. It's a structural one. We need rehab. 9. Citizens should not depend on financial assets as a repository of value and should not rely on fallible expert advice for their retirement. Economic life should be de-financialized. We should learn not to use markets as warehouses of value. They do not harbor the certainties that normal citizens can require, in spite of expert opinions. Investments should be for entertainment. Citizens should experience anxiety from their own businesses, which they control, not from their investments, which they do not control. 10. Make an omelet with the broken eggs. Finally, the crisis of 2008 was not a problem to fix with makeshift repairs, any more than a boat with a rotten hull can be fixed with ad hoc patches. We need to rebuild the new hull with new, stronger material. We will have to remake the system before it does so itself. Let us move voluntarily into a robust economy by helping what needs to be broken break on its own, converting debt into equity, marginalizing the economics and business school establishments, shutting down the Nobel in economics, banning leveraged buyouts, putting bankers where they belong, clawing back the bonuses of those who got us here, by claiming restitution of the funds paid to, say, Robert Rubin or banksters whose wealth has been subsidized by taxpaying school teachers, and teaching people to navigate a world with fewer certainties. Then we will see economic life closer to our biological environment. Smaller firms, a richer ecology, no speculative leverage, a world in which entrepreneurs, not bankers, take the risks, and in which companies are born and die every day without making the news. After this foray into business economics, let us now move to something less vulgar. 9. Amor Fati, How to Become Indestructible. And now, listener, time to part again. I am in Amiyun, the village of my ancestors. 16 out of 16 great-great-grandparents, 8 out of 8 great-grandparents, and 4 out of 4 grandparents are buried in the area, almost all within a 4-mile radius, not counting the great-uncles, cousins, and other relatives. They are all resting in cemeteries in the middle of groves of olive trees in the Kura Valley at the base of Mount Lebanon, which rises so dramatically that you can see the snow above you only 20 miles away. Today, at dusk, I went to St. Sergius, locally called Mar Sarkis from the Aramaic, the cemetery of my side of the family, to say hello to my father and my uncle Dede, who so much disliked my sloppy dressing during my rioting days. I am sure Dede is still offended with me. The last time he saw me in Paris, he calmly dropped that I was dressed like an Australian. So the real reason for my visit to the cemetery was more self-serving. I wanted to prepare myself for where I will go next. This is my plan B. I kept looking at the position of my own grave. A black swan cannot so easily destroy a man who has an idea of his final destination. I felt robust. I am carrying Seneca on all my travels, in the original, as I relearned Latin, reading him in English, that language desecrated by economists and the bureaucrats of the Federal Reserve Bank of the United States, did not feel right, not on this occasion. It would be equivalent to reading Yeats in Swahili. Seneca is the great teacher and practitioner of Stoicism, who transformed Greek-Phoenician Stoicism from metaphysical and theoretical discourse into a practical and moral program of living, a way to reach the summum bonum, an untranslatable expression depicting a life of supreme moral qualities, as perceived by the Romans. But, even apart from this unreachable aim, he has practical advice, perhaps the only advice I can see transfer from words to practice. Seneca is the one who, with some help from Cicero, taught Montaigne that to philosophize is to learn how to die. Seneca is the one who taught Nietzsche the amor fati, love fate, which prompted Nietzsche to just shrug and ignore adversity, mistreatment by his critics, and his disease, to the point of being bored by them. For Seneca, Stoicism is about dealing with loss and finding ways to overcome our loss aversion, how to become less dependent on what you have. Recall the prospect theory of Danny Kahneman and his colleagues. If I gave you a nice house and a Lamborghini, put $1 million in your bank account, and provided you with a social network, then, a few months later, took everything away, you would be much worse off than if nothing had happened in the first place. Seneca's credibility as a moral philosopher, to me, came from the fact that, unlike other philosophers, he did not denigrate the value of wealth, ownership, and property because he was poor. Seneca was said to be one of the wealthiest men of his day. He just made himself ready to lose everything every day. Every day. Although his detractors claim that in real life he was not the Stoic sage he claimed to be, mainly on account of his habit of seducing married women with non-Stoic husbands, he came quite close to it. A powerful man, he just had many detractors, and if he fell short of his Stoic ideal, he came much closer to it than his contemporaries. And just as it is harder to have good qualities when one is rich than when one is poor, it is harder to be a Stoic when one is wealthy, powerful, and respected than when one is destitute, miserable, and lonely. Nihil perditi. In Seneca's Epistle 9, Stilbo's country was captured by Demetrius, called the Sacker of Cities. Stilbo's children and his wife were killed. Stilbo was asked what his losses were. Nihil perditi. I have lost nothing, he answered. Omnia mea mecum sunt. My goods are all with me. The man had reached the Stoic self-sufficiency, the robustness to adverse events, called apatheia in Stoic jargon. In other words, nothing that might be taken from him did he consider to be a good, which includes one's own life. Seneca's readiness to lose everything extended to his own life. Suspected of partaking in a conspiracy, he was asked by the Emperor Nero to commit suicide. The record says that he executed his own suicide in an exemplary way, unperturbed, as if he had prepared for it every day. Seneca ended his essays, written in the epistolary form, with vale, often mistranslated as farewell. It has the same root as value and valor, and means both be strong, i.e. robust, and be worthy. Vale. You can find the notes section and a glossary of terms in the PDF included with this program. This is Joe Ackman. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of The Black Swan, The Impact of the Highly Improbable, second edition, by Nassim Nicholas Taleb. This program was directed by Christina Rooney. Executive producer, Aaron Blank. Text copyright 2007-2010 by Nassim Nicholas Taleb. Production copyright 2018, Penguin Random House, LLC. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.